Alors, bonjour, encore une fois, je me présente. Je suis Daniel Malo de l'Agence Conversité, qui, à la demande du promoteur, a organisé l'avant-midi de discussion avec vous. Je vais en profiter pour présenter les gens qui ont travaillé à l'organisation de cet avant-midi de discussion.
Oui. Bonjour, Raphaël Fischler. Hello. My name is Raphaël Fischler. I'm director of the School of Urban Planning. Alors, je vous souhaite à tous la bienvenue ici, dans un espace qui se veut un espace neutre de discussion sur des enjeux très importants. Alors, merci d'être venu.
Bonjour, je suis Luc Rabouin, directeur général du Centre d'écologie urbaine de Montréal. Donc, on nous a demandé d'être sur le comité aviseur de cette activité-là, justement, pour s'assurer qu'il y ait de la diversité des points de vue, et on est assuré que ça va être très animé.
Bonjour, mon nom est Nick Luca. Je fais un peu tout ici avec la groupe parce que je suis professeur ici en architecture et en urbanisme et je suis aussi un membre du comité adviseur du Centre d'écologie urbaine de Montréal. Je vais vous préciser un peu ce que nous ferons ce matin et je veux commencer avec quelques précisions très importantes. Alors, on est dans un milieu universitaire. L'événement aujourd'hui, ce matin, est subventionné par le promoteur du projet Petite Rivière et il a été organisé par le cabinet Conversité. Pourtant, les écoles d'architecture et d'urbanisme sont les hôtes ce matin. Il s'agit d'une activité publique dans un contexte universitaire. Nous avons trois grands objectifs. Information, vous partagez un peu les informations qui sont intéressantes. Discussion, une discussion publique pour que les gens aient l'occasion de donner leurs avis et réflexion. Alors, les écoles et le Centre d'écologie urbaine de Montréal ont défini le contenu intellectuel et pratique de cet événement avec Conversité et l'œuf. Encore une fois, c'est un débat, c'est une discussion publique. Aucune de ces organisations ne cautionne quelque position ou proposition que ce soit. I'm going to repeat those four positions in English because I think they're very important for the good unfolding of the morning. My name is Nick Luca. I'm a professor here in the School of Architecture and the School of Urban Planning. The event is subsidized by the developer of the Petite Rivière project, and it's been organized by the firm Conversité. The Schools of Architecture and Urban Planning here are the hosts of the event, and this is therefore an event public in the university context. The two schools and the Urban Ecology Center of Montreal have defined the intellectual content in collaboration with Conversité and l'œuf, the firm œuf. And none of these organizations are in advocating a position or a proposition today, whatsoever it may be. Alors, l'ordre du jour. On commence un peu en retard. Nous avons maintenant le mot de bienvenue. Par la suite, on aura des présentations, une description du projet Petite Rivière. Par la suite, un groupe communautaire, les amis de Meadowbrook, vont présenter quelques commentaires et par la suite, on va discuter les grands enjeux. Nous allons donc poursuivre des ateliers de discussion. On va faire une breakout dans les petites salles, dans l'école d'architecture et dans l'école d'urbanisme. Et on va discuter les enjeux, les questions. Par la suite, on va se réunir dans l'auditorium qui est juste là, qui est à des chaises plus confortables, alors, pour une panel de discussion. Et on va finir à midi et demi. Alors, the proceedings are being recorded. We have a video camera here, and the results of the discussions will be made public on the websites of McGill and Conversité. Okay. Alors, bonne nouvelle, si vous n'avez pas encore entendu parler, hier soir, our very own Arcade Fire won a Grammy for their album The Suburbs. Pourquoi j'en parle? Bon, on parle des projets urbains. Et c'est clair que les questions de développement durable urbanisme sont devenus très sexy. Hein? Tout le monde veut en discuter. So, planning issues have become very important. Concerns over sustainable development are at the forefront. The object of today's discussion, then, is to discuss new approaches to sustainable development in urban and suburban contexts. All right? The object is not to debate the project, Petite Rivière, in and of itself. We are very interested in the university context, and you can say that we're in our ivory towers, which is sort of true. We're interested in the processes, in the issues that are raised by the Petite Rivière project. So we want to organize, we wanted to organize a discussion and a debate because the Petite Rivière project presents some very interesting questions for planning, architecture, design, and development in the Montreal context. Okay? We're especially interested in the possibilities that are raised by this project in terms of urban development, urban growth, and the transformation of large sites, large parcels within the metropolitan envelope. Okay? We are therefore not intending today to debate the context in and of itself, and certainly not whether or not it should be built on the Meadowbrook site. Okay? The Meadowbrook Petite Rivière is an interesting pretext for a discussion about urban growth and reurbanization. We really would like to nourish, and I'm speaking very much on behalf of the schools and of the university, the public debate on best practice in planning, urban design, and development. So, a little word on context. Cities in the West, in the industrialized world, are suffering from a number of problems of growth and development. This has been true for many, many decades. We often talk about sprawl. But we also find that many cities, many metropolitan regions, if not all, have a number of large sites within their built-up envelope. These are sites which can conceivably receive or become the context for new neighborhoods or new urban projects. Some of them are disused industrial sites. Some of them are simply unbuilt parcels or stretches of land. Whatever the case, there are often very important ecological values. There are emergent ecologies that we find in any context. And there are, of course, lots of potential values for society in terms of how they're used in the future. The planning and development and organization, adaptive reuse of these sites, introduces some very important questions in terms of the objectives that we have heard so much about for the last 20 or 30 years in terms of sustainable development, etc. By sustainability, we, of course, are referring to ecological viability, economic vitality, and social well-being. Okay, it's not strictly an ecological definition of sustainability that we need to consider. So, here are our key questions, or our key aims for today. To discuss new approaches to sustainable development, I'm sorry about the projector cutting off the T there, in both urban and suburban contexts. And what are the contributions of this very compelling project, very controversial project as well, to the debates in the Montreal context? The case is going to be presented to you, the Meadowbrook site, the Petite Rivière project, and it's situated straddling the Lachine borough and the city of Côte-Saint-Luc, the city that one of the municipalities that demerged from the megacity of Montreal. Okay. I would like to tell you very quickly about two key speakers that we have today, and we're very pleased to welcome them, although we will be discussing the bios and the details of each one of our guests in turn. We have Cornelia Hahn Oberlander, who is a very good friend of McGill, and we're delighted that she's able to join us today. She is a member of the Order of Canada. She's a landscape architect based in Vancouver, which is on the west coast, British Columbia. Okay. And in her career, she has been successfully involved and really shaped design projects, including both high-profile buildings in Canada and the U.S. Some examples include the Robson Square and Provincial Government Courthouse Complex in Vancouver, the National Gallery of Canada, and the Vancouver Public Library. Her firm, Cornelia Han Oberland Landscape Architects, was founded in 1953. So we're very pleased that she's able to join us today. We also have Paul Kephart, who is the president of Rana Creek. He is a designer, a biologist, and an expert in land use planning. He's best known for his efforts, which are truly pioneering, in living architecture, an alternative approach to conventional development, which deploys sustainable development strategies. His firm, Rana Creek, is based in Monterey, California, and specializes in environmental planning, landscape architecture, habitat restoration, and native plant propagation. Alors, voici les questions. Quelles sont les meilleures pratiques dont Montréal pourrait s'inspirer pour façonner les nouveaux quartiers qui seront construits dans les années à venir? What are some of the best practices from which Montreal can take some inspiration for shaping new districts in the coming years? And then, as subtext and as a case study, what can the Petite Rivière project teach us in this respect? Qu'est-ce que le projet Petite Rivière peut nous apprendre à ce titre? We have workshops which are in four themes, okay? And so you will have a focused set of topics and questions to address. Four of them. I only have two on each slide so that you're not overwhelmed with text. Okay, the first one is the ecological sustainability of urban projects. What can we learn from our Petite Rivière project that we're examining today, and how could we improve it? Similar questions are posed in the second workshop, which is on the economic and social sustainability of urban projects. The second pair of themes broaden the focus. Third one is urban growth and conservation of green space. Policies to adopt, what should Montreal do, and the question of eco-territories, vitally important for the island and, of course, the bioregion of Montreal. Finally, discussions on the master plan for the city and the new metropolitan development plan. What are some of the objectives, directions, and norms that should be included in these plans in the light of these projects? One of the issues that has come to light, of course, is that the discussions and some of the controversies around the Meadowbrook Petite Rivière project have to do with the planning framework that existed before and during its inception by the developers.
Alors, Daniel va venir et nous préciser quelques infos sur les ateliers. Voici les quatre thèmes ensemble.
Here are the four themes of the workshops together, and Daniel's just going to give a few precisions now on the logistics of the workshops.
En fait, on va vous donner plus d'informations. Vous avez un petit papier qui indique l'atelier à laquelle vous allez participer. Également, il y a un local, numéro de local inscrit sur le petit papier qu'on vous a remis. On vous donnera plus de détails. D'abord, je voudrais inviter, dans le fond, des groupes à faire une présentation, en commençant par l'équipe des architectes de l'œuf, qui vont vous donner, dans le fond, un portrait rapide d'une vingtaine de minutes sur le projet Petite Rivière. They will be followed by les amis de Meadowbrook. Alors, Danny, if you can and introduce your team. Alors, je vous présente Daniel Pearl de l'équipe de l'œuf. Il a travaillé avec le promoteur Groupe Pacifique au projet qui est soumis, dans le fond, qui sert de cas à la discussion ce matin.
It's a pleasure as a graduate of the School of Architecture here at McGill and having taught here for about a decade to come back here today. It's a place, of course, dear to my heart. I am actually a professor at the School of Architecture of Université Montréal, École d'Architecture de l'Université Montréal, and I will be, for the most part, speaking in English, specifically in respect of my colleagues who are here today. There will be four people partaking in this 20 minutes. Bob Birkebeil, Bob, who's about to come to the front, who's actually going to start the discussion. Luf very clearly has never built a sustainable community, and the client representative of Group Pacific understood that, and for the idea of risk management and inspiration and process enabled us to team up with a firm called BNIM, where Bob Birkebeil, the father of actually integrated design process and sustainability in North America, this happens to be the most humanist of all teams, actually, that we were able to select, not just award-winning. And I think that really describes the kind of team that we built from day one about putting human values and lifestyle ahead of everything else. There's also Laura Lesniewski, another partner at BNIM. She will be presenting. Laura has been at the heart of the process after our initial charrettes in 2007. And they both understand the incredible necessity of having more than just architects around the table on day one. We've had experts from all walks of life, sociologists, journalists, and attempts have been made to be as inclusive as possible. And today is another step in this process of inclusion. We will have one of our dozen or so biologists who have looked at the site. We have to listen to the land, as you'll hear. So Kim Medineau, a very well-known biologist here in Montreal, who's also actually evaluated the site, will interject for a couple of minutes as well. So this is not a very heavy slide-oriented presentation. We hope that everybody read some of the material that was delivered in the original email, as well as the websites are quite complete in describing the story. This is really about a team that's attempting in its best format to continue a dialogue. Bob.
Thanks, Danny. I'm delighted to be here. I apologize that I can't do this in French and English, but I'll try to be brief and share some of what I think are the possibilities for you today and in the future. I would argue that this is the most powerful moment in human history, that never before has our economy and our environment been so uncertain. In fact, large pattern scientists would tell you that even human existence at this point is ever more uncertain. I first became exposed to this in 1992-93 when the National Science Foundation took me to Antarctica. And while I was there, scientists introduced me to the facts. And I was stunned by what they shared. And I should say that at that time they were forecasting some very ominous outcomes for all the major life support systems on the planet. And when I came back to North America and shared these ideas, all my friends said, "Bob, these people are totally crazy." But since then, every forecast they made has been exceeded by reality. Since that time, well, even then, I was reminded of what Einstein said years ago, and that is, we shall require substantially a new manner of thinking if humankind is to survive. So since then, we've been on a path of trying to understand that and sort it out. And our firm has worked from Antarctica to Alaska, from China to Israel. And we've discovered a number of things in that process. And I want to share just three today that I hope inform our conversation here. The first is that our existing communities and economic model is obsolete. It is too expensive, too consumptive, too wasteful, and it is bankrupting us and our natural capital, meaning the underlying supporting environmental system. The second is that it is possible to change that model and create what we would call a regenerative community design. The third is, when that does happen, and we are seeing it now in a number of places around the planet, it is only possible when two things exist. The first is a public-private partnership, because government can no longer do this for us and private developers can't do it on their own. And the second is that that partnership is informed by what we would call a collaborative dialogue of discovery. in looking at what we have before us today and looking at what we have in Montreal and on this planet, this is, in my judgment, a unique opportunity. This, in doing this work, we have seen maybe only 5 developers on the planet who have invested the kind of resources and deep ecological understanding of the ecology and culture of this place, and looking at this from a scientific point of view before they start making decisions in dialogue with you. It is possible here, in my judgment, and you will be the judge over time, to create the first one planet community, and you'll hear more about that, to create the first triple bottom line development, meaning every design, development, investment decision increases the vitality of the social, economic, environmental systems simultaneously, no trade-offs. So I know from just chatting with some of you and following the emails and looking at this and looking at things from the design team and developer that almost everyone's here with a very clear opinion of how this should turn out. And I want to share a little story about David Bohm, a Nobel Prize-winning English physicist, who wrote a little book called On Dialogue. And he wrote it because he noticed all the important decisions in England at the time and in the scientific community and in government were made based on discussion. And he made the point that discussion comes from the same root word as concussion and percussion. He said it's a little like being in a ping-pong match and you're hitting the ball back and forth just long enough to put it away and win. And if you won, someone just lost. So he proposed that we come at these conversations and enter into a dialogue, holding the same passion and beliefs you currently hold, but imagining that you hold something among you that is greater than the most positive thing you can individually imagine. And it's important in that kind of a dialogue to listen more than you speak and try to hear what your colleague or your friend in the conversation is sharing, and try to discover something beyond what we each brought into this room. My belief is that through this process, starting today, we can change the future of human history, and I look forward to seeing how good we are at capturing that dialogue. Thank you.
That's an impossible act to follow. And I didn't have time, and I don't think it's the place today to introduce Luf and all the incredible consultants around the table. Laura will hint at that. But this has never been about an individual. It's about a vision and a client who's actually allowed the vision to stay at the center of a process. So I'd just like to take a few minutes now to clarify what today means to our team and our team's perspective. Really, it's not about debating the degree of existing biodiversity on a golf course. It's not about the true cost of infrastructure, as quoted by one City Hall official or another. It's not about whether safety routes to or off and on the site are sufficient. It's not about questions related to government standards on distances that housing should be built from railway tracks. But I think it's critical to know that if some of those issues are blocking panelists at the end of the day, the experts to be able to answer some of those technical questions are here today. But today really is a university setting. And really, all these issues are technical ones that can be solved in a conventional manner between a private developer and city officials. And even afterwards, through a public consultation process in due time. And this event has nothing to do with trying to sidetrack that process. So what is today? Today is about whether a private developer, insightful developers who are in business to make a profit, can play a role in leading and partnering with our cities. And if so, how? I think for me, having worked with social housing groups and the non-private sector for so many years at LIF and learning from Benny Farm, the one thing that gets us scared is cities don't seem to have the courage at the moment to play the leadership role at the speed that we need to make change. And we need to find a way to engage the private sector. It is about how cities and grassroots communities can work towards the same goal,
high-quality living, where greening and densifying can occur side by side and even intertwine. Without densification, we cannot live comfortably within our eco footprint. We cannot afford walkable communities. However, without sufficient programmed green space next to or amongst sufficiently dense housing, in the spirit of New York Central Park, we cannot stop the annual exodus of 20,000 families from the island of Montreal to the off-island suburbs. And that's causing way more of an ecological disaster than how we try and green and densify Montreal. Currently, Montreal offers only two models. Maybe I'm generalizing. Downtown densification, like the projects that are very good, Les Bassins du Nouveau-Havre, and in some ways Griffintown, where many families are not comfortable. For those families who are not comfortable with vertical living, although it's been proven to be quite successful in parts of Vancouver, what are the other options? There are the partially densified suburbs such as Bois-Franc or the Plan Pierrefonds West Master Plan, where density is somewhere around the 30 units per hectare. This density is better than the current 5 to 10 or 20 units per hectare in the older suburbs, but this 30 to 40 units per hectare will not financially nor systemically allow us to sufficiently reduce our eco footprint. It won't allow a quantum change to get the lifestyle that Bob was talking about. Today, it's all about how to live in a densified urban setting, even in suburbia, where people of all ages can live together, enable the repairing of the socioeconomic holes. The site is a little bit like an orphan, sitting there, not really part of Côte Saint-Luc, not part of Montreal West, disconnected from Ville-Saint-Pierre, disconnected from the Sheen. And in a certain sense, this is actually its biggest problem. It is about discussing how much green space for recreation, food, production, heat island sink protection, biodiversity that nurtures coexistence, and how much is necessary. It's about encouraging a shift from privatization of space, which is the definition almost of suburbia since the 1950s, where 70% of the space is privatized, 20% are roads, and another 10% are public parks. This is not the social contract of where we want our kids to go and where families should be going in the future. Yes, there are dense projects downtown, and yes, there will be rural settings, but we need to find a formula that actually enables projects to find a medium density, somewhere between 60 and 100 units per hectare next to the lungs and the green spaces of our cities, and they actually nourish each other. It is about encouraging a shift where, in the end, the safety of children is prioritized. What if we actually have a project where all children could actually cross out of their building and not have to cross a major artery or a major road in order to get to a green space? This was what suburbia tried to promise and didn't succeed in giving, and I think our planning has attempted to go in this direction. Green belts in cities can be reinforced, connected to new development, and provide some financial and human security required to assure the long-term viability if the right vision and conditions are set. So what's stopping all this if it sounds so exciting? Well, developers don't have a very good track record of doing the right thing. There's a lack of trust, insufficient tools to really evaluate and follow through. There's a need to develop the right instruments to enable trust and accountability between the private sector and the public partnering. It's about discussing how construction sites need to mitigate nuisances and problems during construction and not be given simply lip service. One Planet Community, Bob referred to it, a nonprofit organization that specifically attempts to set in place quantifiable and qualitative metrics to ensure that a developer carries through on their promises and over an extended period of time, unlike some of the products like LEED that exist out there. It is about planning a roadmap on how to start a dialogue with all interested and concerned groups. It's about planning action, taking the next steps. One of the big lessons from Benny Farm was giving a chance for everybody to have a voice around the table. And today we have one of our panelists who was instrumental in ensuring that happened. To date, non-governmental organizations, NGOs, have been trying to protect green space as much as possible in and around Montreal. This is critical. We all agree. Mayor Tremblay stated three ways of doing so this year at the Biodiversity Conference, and that efforts are needed in all three realms. One key one was encouraging privately owned land to be protected as well. But right now, the precedent being set is really just a minimum of 10% green space for those private large-scale developments and about 20 to 30% housing of some forms of affordability. Petite Rivière can go much beyond this and create a much-needed precedent where maybe the city can negotiate with a developer where 30 to 50% of these private sites, zoned residential, can actually be put into a protected state of one sort or another. In return for such negotiations, private developers should work with cities in sharing costs and studying how to go about this process. In the end, I think it's not a question of one project. There was a mention recently about projects, what can we do in the Turcotte Yards? I hope that next spring, the Turcotte Yards actually turns into one of the best 78-hectare parks that we need in this city. Next to highways with all the dust and noise, we're going to need filters. And these filters will be parks, and they will be reinforcing the eco-territory of the Falaise Saint-Jacques. Our goal is we need public realm projects that have land in the public realm, and we need private developers, and we need them both engaged. Laura.
Good morning. My name is Laura Lesneski. It's an honor to be here, and I also apologize for not having French in my list of languages. So I am going to have actually many images that I'll try to run through rather quickly, but I hope that they're helpful to you. I'm speaking from the perspective of the project team. We came in 2007, the team came to a site and a vision that was cast before us by the developer. And this was a developer that was asking us to do things, ask questions like, how can we develop to improve quality of life without the burden of existing resources and within our ecological footprint? These are not common questions for developers to ask us in our projects. And so we knew that this was going to be a very different type of project and the ones that align with the values that we have in our practice. And it could be simply stated as this, which Group Pacific said, we are determined to do things differently and responsibly, and we have only witnessed that over the past more than three years. The team that was assembled is highly diverse and highly integrated, and as Danny said, have been able to address a lot of the technical issues that come with the site and the location that it is. It's a very impressive team, really dedicated to achieving this one planet goal. And we started by asking these questions. What if on this site we listened to the trees that are there? If we listened to the water that is there? To the wildlife that is there and that's not there? If we listen to the people that are in the neighboring communities that use that property, the technical experts that could know how to develop the property, and what if we listen to the planet? And I think we're all learning that, at least in Quebec, if everybody on the planet lived like someone from Quebec, we would need three planets to survive. In Canada, it would be four planets. In the U.S., shame on us, it would take five planets. And so we're all working towards trying to reduce our impact on the planet so future generations can live here. And so we were given this site, and I'm going to have Kim Marineau come up and say a few words.
Did you say that I have my picture? Thank you. Hi. Good morning. I will do my presentation in French. Is it okay for you? Thank you. En 2009 et en 2010, nous avons fait des inventaires. On était une équipe de biologistes, donc on était quatre. Une spécialiste de la faune ailée, les oiseaux, les mammifères et un spécialiste de l'herpétofaune pour la faune, ainsi que un inventaire de la végétation sur le site. Vous savez tous que c'est un golfe avec du gazon et des arbres essentiellement, mais il y a quand même de la biodiversité sur ce site-là. J'ai décidé de vous réveiller ce matin avec une belle... ça ne sort pas très bien. Une définition de la biodiversité. Qu'est-ce que la biodiversité? C'est évidemment plusieurs choses. En fait, c'est la diversité des espèces biologiques, la diversité génétique à l'intérieur des espèces et la diversité des habitats. Donc, on a regardé un petit peu aussi le site sous cet aspect-là. Donc, c'est toutes les formes vivantes qui sont importantes dans un, quand on regarde la biodiversité dans son ensemble. Au niveau de la flore du site, on a comme résultat 105 espèces vasculaires qui ont été inventoriées sur ce site-là. Évidemment, il y en a plusieurs, c'est des espèces de gazon, espèces introduites, donc dans le pâturin, entre autres. Donc, il y avait un grand nombre d'espèces, mais peu d'espèces d'intérêt, si on veut. Mais dans les espèces d'intérêt, on a trouvé la sanguinaire du Canada, qui est une espèce qui pousse en sous-bois. Donc, finalement, sous le couvert des arbres, il y a quand même une flore de sous-bois qui a pu se développer dans les lisières, entre autres, les lisières forestières autour du golfe. Il y a aussi la mateusie, vous savez, les têtes de violon, donc qui ont été trouvées dans un des petits milieux humides qu'il y a sur le site, qui est une espèce qui est désignée vulnérable au Québec parce qu'on l'accueille pour, évidemment, vendre au IGA et pour la manger. Ainsi que le carioval, un individu seulement, qui est une espèce aussi qui est susceptible d'être désignée au Québec, donc qui est peut-être éventuellement qui va être protégée par la loi. C'est les trois espèces d'intérêt qu'on a trouvées sur le site. Ici, vous avez une petite photo de la principale découverte au niveau de la faune, évidemment. Dans la plupart des sites résiduels, naturels, à Montréal, il y a de la couleuvre brune, donc c'est une espèce d'intérêt. Il y en a essentiellement dans tous les milieux qui sont un peu laissés à eux-mêmes, donc toutes les friches industrielles ou les petits boisés, ou même aux endroits où il y a beaucoup de déchets, c'est une espèce qu'on trouve assez fréquemment sur l'île, mais qui est seulement située dans la région de Montréal. Au niveau des oiseaux, on a trouvé 27 espèces d'oiseaux nicheurs sur le site. C'est un site qui est quand même intéressant. C'est un espace vert dans lequel il y a des oiseaux qui passent, mais il y a peu d'oiseaux qui nichent comme tels sur le site. Un seul nid de rapaces a été trouvé, un nid de faucon émérion, qui était utilisé au printemps dernier. Au niveau des mammifères, évidemment, c'est des espèces communes. Écureuil gris, marmotte commune et renard roux, mais il y a quand même un certain potentiel pour le lapin, la moufette, évidemment, et le raton laveur. Mais c'est quand même un site qui n'a pas un grand intérêt au niveau des mammifères. Au niveau des amphibiens reptiles, résultat, crapaud d'Amérique qui a été découvert, ainsi que... je me suis trompée. Et la couleuvre brune, c'est les deux seules espèces d'amphibiens reptiles. Il y aurait pu y avoir de la couleuvre rayée, mais on n'en a pas trouvé. Donc, voici les localisations des espèces, où est-ce qu'elles ont été trouvées. Donc, essentiellement, les espèces ont été trouvées d'intérêt, je parle, dans la lisière qui longe la voie ferrée. Donc, le reste du terrain est beaucoup plus... dégradé, si on veut, où il y a moins d'intérêt au niveau de la faune et de la flore, parce qu'il n'y a pas assez de structures végétales pour abriter beaucoup d'habitats d'espèces floristiques ou fauniques. Oui. Donc, à la fin de notre étude, on a quand même émis certaines recommandations générales à l'équipe qui fait la planification de ce projet-là. Protéger les espèces d'intérêt, les trois espèces végétales qu'on vous a nommées, donc l'arbre, le carrier, ainsi que les petites colonies des deux espèces rares aussi. Conserver les arbres matures sur le projet et les lisières boisées autour, donc ça permet de conserver des habitats, des petits habitats pour la petite faune. Augmenter la présence des milieux humides et riverains et aménager ceux-ci de manière à augmenter le potentiel écologique. Comme vous savez, il y a deux petits ruisseaux sur ce terrain-là. Évidemment, si on pouvait avoir une meilleure qualité d'eau, avec peut-être un peu de rétention d'eau sur le site, ça augmenterait les possibilités, peut-être pour la sauvagine, entre autres, ou d'autres espèces comme les grenouilles. Augmenter la quantité de végétaux, relier l'ensemble par un corridor vert à d'autres îlots de verdure qu'il y a dans la région allemande, si on veut. contrôler les espèces envahissantes et parce que quand on laisse un terrain comme un golfe redevenir naturel dans certains secteurs, évidemment, il y a des possibilités que les espèces envahissantes prennent beaucoup de place et favoriser les espèces indigènes dans le territoire. Je vous remercie beaucoup.
OK. I know we are out of time, and so I'm going to just go to one image and just say, and just say a few words because I know we have to cut out a lot of what we were going to say. The important thing, there's a lot that we tried to do in this project that we're trying to make a continuous park and design a development, a very dense development within a park. And instead of having, I know that a lot of people here in the community feel a sense of loss at losing some open space or a golf course. And what I would encourage everyone to do is if you're in that place of feeling a loss with this project, is to consider the potential of what this could be. To have 70% of this property become a public park instead of a private development that it is right now, that it's a very important thing to consider. There's been a lot of, I encourage you also to just go to the website for this project to learn about all of the diversity and intensity of the design and how we addressed key technical, social, and economic issues in this development. So I apologize, I cannot give the presentation that I wanted to, but we're out of time.
Alors, merci beaucoup, l'équipe œuf. Ça, c'était la première de nos trois interventions. Le ton est également partagé pour les trois interventions. Ça, c'était le premier qui porte sur le projet en soi. Nous sommes très contents de maintenant inviter une équipe qui parle des enjeux et d'une opposition, des thèses d'opposition au projet développé. Je ne vais pas présenter les bios de toute l'équipe. Je leur laisse se présenter. Mais nous sommes contents d'avoir M. Campbell Stewart et Dida Burku et Patrick Ash qui est juste en train d'ouvrir la présentation. Vous en êtes prêts, M. Stewart?
Merci beaucoup. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. My name is Campbell Stewart, and I am the secretary of Les Amis de Meadowbrook. And I'd like to say thank you to the organizers of this forum for the opportunity to explain our case here. I hope everybody here does understand that it is, in fact, not possible to have the discussion outside the context of the green space itself. And we appreciate the attempt to make this discussion into a discussion which is more general, but from our point of view, it is actually quite impossible to do so, and I think the last slide kind of shows it. Okay. First, let me and us congratulate Mr. Perl and his team on the wonderful project that they do have. It is a wonderful project. There's absolutely no question about that. But we would like to emphasize, underline, underscore, and highlight in the strongest possible terms that we're not against the project. We're only against it being built on Meadowbrook. We, as we have done in the past on a number of occasions, we have tried to interest Groupe Pacific on finding some true brown space that they can build on for a swap. It's entirely possible. I think there have even been a number of discussions in that regard. So that's really where we want to go on this. We want to have a win-win for everybody in the island of Montreal, that is to save a green space and turn it into a park. We're not out to preserve a golf course. Our idea is to have a win-win for everybody. So we've been working on this since 1989 to preserve Meadowbrook. And it's entirely voluntary. The Les Amis de Meadowbrook is entirely voluntary and is funded by donations only. Our mission is, in fact, to protect Meadowbrook and turn it into a public park for everybody, which is, in fact, what the Lebrecht Commission in 2009, after public hearings, did recommend. As you can see from the handout, which is passed around, and I do apologize, I don't know whether you got a chance to see it, I know that there was some information which was circulated on the project earlier, so we're just circulating ours to you by hand now. But do understand that when the Conseil Régional Environnement de Montréal and the Green Coalition, the Sierra Club, and the Équiterre and David Suzuki Foundation, the Bird Protection Quebec, et cetera, say publicly that they would like to preserve this as a green space, that's a very serious issue and it should not be dismissed out of hand. Okay? And when you're talking about the CRE Montréal, the Conseil Régional Environnement de Montréal, you're talking about 60 member organizations. When you talk about the Green Coalition, you're talking about 40 member organizations. We have two speakers today. The first is Dita Berku. She's an attorney and the city councillor of Côte Saint-Luc and has been since 1990. And her talk is based on the actual nuts and bolts of the urban planning issues and problems which this site does present. The second speaker is Patrick Ash. He's a biologist and director of Héritage Laurentien, and his talk is on the actual nature of the biodiversity and the actual whether or not it actually is a green building if it is being done on green space. So without wasting any more of everybody's time, I will ask Dita to start.
Is this it? Do you have my... Hi. Bonjour. Je m'appelle Dita Berku. Je suis conseillère municipale à Côte-Saint-Luc. And proud to say that I've been at this for 20 years. I hope I won't be at this for another 20 years, but we'll see how this dialogue works. I have a presentation. I'm going to have to zip through it. It's not easy. I have total respect for the fact that you had a lot to say, and you know, we want to hear it, and we hope that we can exchange views later during the workshops. So basically, my presentation is on security access and proximity issues. I was a little shocked when the professor said that this was not about the location, because that's all I prepared. I was asked to prepare, and I presented the abstract, and it was submitted as such. So from our perspective, what we're going to talk about and what I'm going to talk about is the question of suitability of this project on this site. And when Daniel Pearl says, you know, these are just technical issues that the engineers and architects and technicians can work out later, I can tell you that I've got boxes full. I love props. This is just one of my many boxes, but I've got lots of boxes of technical reports and engineering studies, traffic studies that go back to the 1990s. I've been discussing technical issues for the past 20 years, and these are not easy to resolve. So I'm going to let Patrick talk about the value of the green space, the ecological value of the green space. I'm going to talk about what I call technological risk. In 1990, when I started this, I used to go to the MUC meetings, and I used to discuss technological risk. And it's kind of a code that I kind of invented myself, because there was no concept of proximity to railway yards and industrial uses, etc. So we're just going to do a quick overview. This is Meadowbrook. You can see, I'm sorry, I don't have a flash pointer, but the lower portion is the Côte Saint-Luc side. The upper triangle is the Lachine side. On the right, you see this. This thing here. That's the Sorton Yards, and that's where the AMT is planning to put. Are you going to? No, you do it. Go ahead. I can't think and do it at the same time. Okay, so that's next. Same thing. This is the car park for the railway yard. That's the Sorton Yards. This is Lachine. And we go on. Montreal West is on the top left-hand quadrant. Okay, this is Côte Saint-Luc Road, which comes into a dead end, total dead end. And I have spoken to the AMT, and I have spoken to CP, and they're not opening this anytime soon because, and I'll show you this afterwards if you're interested, the AMT came to Côte Saint-Luc and presented very clearly to us their proposal. And their proposal is to build the Glen Yard repair shop on the Sorton part here, in this part here, and it occupies the entire space, about 3 to 4 million square feet. So they're not allowing any transit traffic, viaducts, underpasses, overpasses. Forget about that. Okay, next slide. Okay, so this is section 4.19 of the Plan d'urbanisme de Montréal. So I'm going to work backwards. We'll start with the last thing that happened in terms of urban planning. The last thing that happened in terms of urban planning was 4.19 of the urban plan. I'm going to just walk you through the points. Number one, put into place a mechanism of collaboration between all the stakeholders, including citizens, railways, cities, and environmental groups. We heard, listen to the people. We say it too. Listen to the people, but not only the people, the neighbors. And the neighbors happen to be railway yards and industrial use. Number two, study the issues of access and traffic with a view to open up the dead end, and notably through Normand and Lachine. This is the MUC, the City of Montreal. This is the urban plan adopted by Lachine. I see my friend Bernie Blanchette here today. We're the best of friends. I was leader. He was leader. We continue to dialogue. And he obviously wants to develop in Lachine because it's a heritage from Ville-Saint-Pierre. They promised them in the marriage when they married Ville-Saint-Pierre with Lachine that they were going to bring in a big dowry, which was called the development of Meadowbrook. It's not happening right now, and I don't think it ever will because, you know, the value of that property has gone down from $16 million, now it's $10 million, and it keeps dropping, not because it's developable, but because the market itself has recognized when the developer bought it for 50 cents a square foot, $3 million for 57 hectares, that this property is not worthy of being developed. So when you say it's one of the only developers on the planet, sure, you can, you know, you can speculate and hope and pray and wish that one day you're going to turn that $3 million into a profit. So, envisager l'aménagement d'une gare de train. Again, I spoke to the AMT. The AMT train stops Dorval, Lachine, Montreal West. It's in to date, and there's no chance that that train is going to stop at that stop. Atténuer les nuisances générées par les activités ferroviaires dans le milieu de vie. Well, that's the whole issue of proximity, and we're going to get to that very quickly, and évaluer, tenir compte des capacités des goûts, I forgot my translation, evaluate and take into account the capacity of infrastructure for water and sewer system. This also means costing the investment. So yes, it is about cost. Oh, yes, it is about cost. Yes, it is about cost. Okay, so we'll continue. Next. This is, why is Côte Saint-Luc different from all other cities? Okay, this is the railway map, the island of Montreal, and as you can see, we are in a railway yard, okay? That's what it is. That's the reality of our city, and Meadowbrook is this tiny little green space down there which sort of buffers between the railway yards, very intensive, and the residential neighborhood. Next slide, please. This is the green map of the island of Montreal, and similarly, you see a gaping hole in the middle, because there's no green space in the middle, and that green space, equidistant from Mount Royal, as is Parc Maisonneuve, which is about the same size as Parc Maisonneuve, we would have a green space right here, which would, in fact, service the community of the Great Southwest. Next slide, please. This is the heat map, as you can see again, very clearly, and I have all these in hard copy so we can look at them in the workshops. This is where we are. We're right in the center of the hotspot, the concrete, the brown fields, the industrial lands that need a counterpoint. They need that green space to be able to breathe so that the residents of that southwest can have some fresh, green and air during the summer. Next slide, please. That's Meadowbrook right there. You see it? And be interesting to talk to Kim about what she saw, the vegetation along the tracks, doesn't seem so green on this map. So there's something really that we need to reconcile in terms of that information. Next slide, please. Okay. I'd like to talk to you about Côte Saint-Luc. This is the Côte Saint-Luc portion. Meadowbrook is here. I really needed a pointer, I'm sorry. And you'd think that all our complaints would be where it's closest to the tracks, right? Logic. However, watch where our biggest complaints are coming from. Next slide. They're coming from up here because CP doesn't just run trains. They rent their space to asphalt plants, not anymore, but they used to on the Sorton Yards, to industrial parks, to gate houses for cars and trucks and all the rest of it. And what happens is when we developed along here, I, of course, voted against it because it was way too close and we destroyed a whole strip of green. We didn't put in a proper buffer. But the council voted 4-4 and the mayor broke the tie, the former mayor, Mr. Libman, and he's admitted that it was a mistake. And this is the place where Michel Spinard from CP took us in 2002. We all put on our hard hats, Mayor Tremblay and D'Souza and Bernie and from Anjou to Beaconsfield, and he took us for a ride in the yards. And the very first place he took us, I was deeply ashamed, he took us to Wallenberg. And he turned to all the mayors and councillors on the train, and we were drinking and had trinkets and laughing, and he said, you take a look at this. This is what not to do. And I clearly turned to them and I said, well, I told you not to do. So it's not that it's so close to the tracks. They put a trucking park there. They put all kinds of things there because it's space they need and use. Next slide, please. This is the Wallenberg. You'll see it looks innocuous enough. It's not even right on a track. But that's where we get the biggest complaints. Dispute resolution, conciliation, CTA, Canadian Transport Agency, CP, our city clerk is on it full time, and complaints that we've got constantly. Next slide, please. The proximity guidelines and best practices. This is a result of 10 years of demands and negotiations. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities, 1,775 municipalities, and all the railways of Canada have come up together in 2007 with something called proximity guidelines. What does it mean? It means common sense. Don't build near railway yards. So the next slide will show you, I'll read it to you when we can do, look at it. The recommended minimum building setback and berm heights are as follows. 300 meters setback for residential use from a rail freight yard. Next slide, please. We measured it. What is 300 meters from a rail freight yard? And this is a very busy freight yard. I just told you about the AMT installations. It's all of the Lachine side, except for a tiny little corner in the front. There. This is the plan d'urbanisme of the Ville Saint-Pierre, 1990. What does it say? It says, in order to build on Meadowbrook, if we're to build on Meadowbrook, these are the things we need to do. We need to widen Côte Saint-Luc Road. It's not in the books right now. Connect to Radcliffe or Blossom. Very difficult. Extend Côte Saint-Luc to the 2 and 20. I just explained to you that's not happening anytime soon because it's way too expensive, and I've got the technical reports here to prove it. It's millions, $10 million in 1993. Build an underpass towards the western tip to pass the railway corridor, and build an access route on the eastern tip. I came up with the idea of asking for an eastern tip. I have technical report as well from Beauchemin, Beaton, Lapointe from 1993 on that point. None of these conditions will or have been met by the present project, nor can they be met. And so in conclusion, I say that the proposal we are discussing is pure marketing without any solid basis. There's no business case. No engineering reports, no technical reports, no traffic studies, no train station, no road or emergency access, no extensions, underpasses or bypasses, no safe setbacks conforming to industry guidelines, and access, security and proximity issues are not met, and this project, in my opinion, cannot proceed. So my conclusions, I've put up very simply the last slide. Meadowbrook is not suitable for development, insufficient access, lack of adequate emergency egress, no station, too close to the rail yards, and surrounded by noise, vibration, and pollution. thank you.
Thank you, Dita. Essentially, since unfortunately we weren't given much time to prepare and present, since our time is very limited, I just figured I might as well just go through a few quick points. We've talked about the question of the project itself. We talked about the question of whether or not it's a good development. And in particular, we said it's not a good site to develop. There's clear indications in that respect, but there are as well many other indications, many other elements that have to be considered within such a project. One aspect that has to be considered is the need to not look only at a little site. You can have tunnel vision and look at just a small element, but you have to look at all of the elements within a community. What are the needs of the community? What are the preoccupations, social, economic, health, environmental? What are the geographic limitations? We've seen that they're quite limited for the site. And one of the things we've been trying to push for, which the Petite Rivière people have taken on, is the concept of creating a greenway network. And it is something interesting, but there are limitations to the site. One of them being that much of the southwestern Montreal region is actually part of the community that has the least access to natural areas and green spaces in Montreal. And Montreal is one of the communities, according to some studies, that has the least natural areas and green space in all of Canada. So we're in the least of the least, and we're in a situation right now where there is an interest in protecting natural areas. We are one of the only cities that has neither a greenway network or a greenbelt network. So there's a lot of work to be done to try to give natural areas to people or renaturalized areas as well. Another aspect that you have to look at is the concept of sustainable development, which includes, as you know, society, economy, and the environment. But when you're talking about sustainable development, it's not just limited to climate change. Sustainable development covers a whole bunch of other issues that have to be considered within a community. Protecting biodiversity is one excellent example. You have to make sure that you protect ecosystems for various uses. Protecting biodiversity is good, for example, as a regulator for climate change, for other factors, food security, medical, and so on throughout the world. Plant biodiversity in Quebec, there's a new study that came out that evaluates the economic impact of plant biodiversity in Quebec to $55 billion a year. 55 milliards de dollars par année. The economics of biodiversity just in the Montreal region. Presently, $1.9 billion is spent by residents of the Metropolitan Montreal community doing nature and environment-related activities. Tourism right now, ecotourism-oriented activities, are the fastest expanding form of tourism in the province. They represent also activities that people want to do, not in the boonies, but near urban environments. So if we give them areas where they can do activities, they will use them and they will spend the money locally. 1.9 billion is five times what les congrès, les activités, les conférences brings to Montreal annually as a revenue. Wildlife watching, as an example, is presently an activity done by 66.1 million Americans. It represents $95.8 billion and more than a million jobs. And it's expanding in Quebec. Quebec has been kind of off on the side because the older community has not been doing it as much. But now when you look at the younger population, 25 to 34-year-olds, for example, 27.8% of the population do wildlife watching on an annual basis. Heat island effect. Dita mentioned already briefly this. Plants serve as filters for pollution. We have rail yards, we have highways, we have industrial neighborhoods. All these elements bring pollution, and Meadowbrook is strategically located to serve as a buffer to reduce this pollution at least a little bit. There's also a question of environmental justice. Environmental justice, by definition, is a question of looking at communities who have suffered the most from most of the environmental problems, and the idea is to try to give them some benefits. If you look at communities, for example, in the South Bronx, or in southwestern Montreal. You have communities that have had the highways go through them, the garbage dumps, the train yards, the railway lines, the industries, and they have been given all of the negative aspects. Well, maybe they should have, given the fact that they're the area in the province that has the least access to green space, maybe they should have some access for green spaces. The example of St. Pierre is a perfect example of this. By the way, New York City, they just spent $50 million in 2010 to create a greenway network within the South Bronx. This is the same situation. There is a benefit, and many other cities are recognizing it. Let's try to do it in Montreal. So if you look at this now, one of the questions is the question that says there's not significant biodiversity. Kim mentioned that within the edge habitats, there were some plants, there were some elements of interest. Yes, there is. One of the interesting aspects is that the soil on much of the site has not been altered. For example, if you look at the stream here, one of the last streams in Montreal, it's covered with ice, but you can notice the slopes on either side. This is actually where the original stream used to flood in spring. And now, because the water is controlled, it just trickles through. But comparatively, you still have the original shape. You still have the original floodplains. You still have some ponds. You all have a fair amount of biodiversity that still remains in there. We've mentioned ferns. We've mentioned the hickory tree, the shagbark hickory. Kim hasn't mentioned, for example, hawthorns. There's some hawthorns that were identified as potentially some of the largest species of hawthorns, individual hawthorns in the Montreal region, found on the Meadowbrook site, according to one of a plant specialist who visited the site recently. You found spring flowers. One thing we should know is that if a spring flower is there, it takes for one spring flower for many of these species sometimes 5 to 10 years for them to attain maturity. And if you find a grouping of spring flowers together, very often it's because these flowers were present 100 years ago. They grow very slowly. They have a very short development cycle. And if you can protect them, you're protecting not just little plants along the edge of a golf course, but you're protecting one of the last samples of the forest that used to be here 100 years plus ago. So one other aspect that's quite interesting is the strategic positioning of Meadowbrook. It's located directly on one corridor from the Lake St. Louis, where most pastorins migrate through. And you have specific sites that are known as some of the best birdwatching sites in the region, Mount Royal, Summit Park, Botanical Gardens, and then towards the Boucherville Islands. Meadowbrook is just at the beginning. If we rehabilitated it, it would become a beautiful site for birdwatching and nature activities. Rehabilitation very often is viewed as something that's hard to do. It is not necessarily simple, but there are methods, there are ways. Whoops. Héritage Laurentien, for example, has rehabilitated right now various sites in the Montreal region. The bottom one is Desrapides Park. 3 years after we restored the habitat in that site, we quadrupled duck nests. We increased the number of species by a few dozen species of birds. Much more can be done with simple rehabilitation. Another question is the question of habitat size. I'm just taking here a few examples of birds and their minimal habitat size. What you'll notice is, yeah, some species will take urban habitats with fragmented ecosystems, but some species will take huge habitats, and some species will take a few dozen hectares to survive. The essential element that you come out of it is that if you take a site like Meadowbrook, divide it in two by a development in the middle, and say, well, the birds will travel through the houses. That's not how birds behave when you're looking at birds that require more habitat space. Given the fact that we have so little, we should protect the entirety if we want to maximize biodiversity. And that's a basic question. I'm a wildlife biologist. We've planted more than 115,000 native trees, bushes, and plants as part of habitat restorations. That's a basis. The larger you have your space, the more biodiversity you're going to have. So the other aspect is the question of One Planet Living. One Planet Living aims at preserving natural habitats and wildlife. If you develop on the site and you reduce biodiversity as far as its potentials, you're not really helping that much. If you're looking at questions of culture and heritage, there are historical and archaeological aspects linked to the site. And at the very least, you need to do some archaeological digs to really find out, because it has the potential for settlements dating back 4,000 years. So these aspects have to be considered. Unfortunately, I can't get into detail. I don't have the time, but there's a lot more that can be covered. The site, we've demonstrated, is ill-suited. So if it's ill-suited, it's not the best for sustainable transport. Rail line, the stop for the railway, is not approved by MT, and there's no indication that's ever going to happen. So it's an unrealistic goal. Given that, you're trying to condense 3 times the population relative to the neighborhood that's next to it. And then already as it is, there's problems with traffic. And you're supposing that it's just going to travel in and out without any trouble. It's not realistic as far as promoting zero carbon. And when it comes to health and happiness, you have to look at the health and happiness of all the community around it. And it has been demonstrated that we need to protect as much habitat as possible for all the community, not just the people who live on a future development. It's the only way to create a park. Okay, thank you. I'm not convinced. Saying that Montreal should spend tens of millions, maybe 100 million plus, according to some estimates in Montreal, to support a development that would create a park for a community, you kind of have to wonder. It's not when it spent, they spent only $3 million to buy it, and there's other alternatives that could allow the protection and the development of a park on the whole site for much less than tens, maybe 100 million plus. To say also that it can be done, there's efforts to naturalize sites. Héritage Laurentien, we have 2,000 volunteers some years who come by to do plantations, habitat restorations, greening projects. There are alternatives that can be considered. So it's not only the alternative. Thank you very much. I'm just going to go through all that to say that there are other activities as well that can be done on the site. And it's not true that we just want forests or we just want a golf course, but we are welcome to come by and talk to me more about it later. Thank you very much.
So, thank you, Patrick. Just a second. I have a special request from some of you in the audience and from some of our moderators. They would like to have 2 extra minutes from the left to have some the key facts, you know, about the project. Can you make it in 2 minutes? Laura? They need to know more before they go to the workshop.
And just while we're waiting, I should specify my comments that we, of course, do want, we have the case of Meadowbrook as, and the Petite Riviere as our specific, but that the forum is a discussion of what kinds of issues. The breakout sessions in the atelier are where we'd like to discuss the bigger questions.
Okay, 2 minutes. I will do my best. As I was saying before, I want to just mention a few of the things about the project. The good news is, actually, I agree with a lot of what was just said in terms of what's required on the site in order to make it viable. Maybe the only thing I disagree in is that I do think that this site is perhaps one of the best places to do this kind of work. So what we were trying to do was to make sure that the community would be a walkable community. We do believe that it can connect to transit. And that it would be, a lot of amenities would be available not only for the people in this community, but for the neighboring communities to the north and also to Lachine to the south. And so we were trying to have there was a continuous park that isn't just about forests. It is about urban agriculture and recreation and things like that. To have the community center walkable, continue the urban grid, make connections between the neighboring communities, and to have density that's appropriate coming from the north and getting more dense towards the south. Oops. This is the project that was the last project that was designed for this site that was approved to go forward, and by the city. It did not go forward, but this is an alternative that I don't think anyone is interested in doing. So on this project, the key points on this project are that we wanted to develop a significant park, provide significant biodiversity, revive the St. Pierre River that runs through, add a constructed wetland to the area to handle stormwater treatment, create the train stop, provide affordable housing and social housing that would amount to about 30% of the overall project, and provide 30% of the units that would be accessible from grade. We paid a lot of attention to the diversity of housing that would be available. We were designing a compact urban development a community, incorporating shared space design that no more than 30% would be private, very different than what is typical for developed land, that there'd be synergies with the adjacent industrial sector. We'd be creating opportunities for partnerships, which I do think are very real, and we would test innovative infrastructure that are important to the viability of our cities overall, and that this would be an incredible national model shown here in Montreal for all of Canada and actually all of North America. We in the U.S. have a lot to learn from the potential of this project. This represents about 1,500 units that's very dense in the center of the site so that we could provide 70% public space. This shows the trees that we would be paying attention to keep on the site, which comes from both the history of agriculture in the area. Those were the original hedgerows, some of which were then added to for the golf course. And this is the kind of biodiversity that we are talking about enriching. So this is what's there right now. And over time, over 1 to 5 years, we'd be increasing biodiversity. And then over the course of 5 to 25 years, we're proposing it would be a very rich and addressing many of the issues that Patrick was bringing up. From the One Planet community perspective, we have strong, aggressive goals for each of the 10 principles. 40% of all food from local farms and on-site gardens, 54% of the site for natural habitat, green space, and urban agriculture. That's for the One Planet, and the developer has committed to beyond that, to 70%. Reducing being carbon neutral for all of the buildings on the site. Reducing municipal water use significantly. Being very aggressive in terms of using local and regional materials, reducing construction and solid waste by 98%. This is incredibly aggressive, and it's something that's very important to us. As members of living on this planet, it's incredible. Reducing transport emissions by 71% for the residents, enhancing local heritage and culture. And Patrick, I 100% agree that this is very important and that there are great amenities on the site that we need to look at and pay attention to, and the team is committed to it. Yes. You're welcome. Thank you. Yes.
Can you just show your concept map, please? That one. You say there's 1,500 homes on the site, right? Do you know the number of homes that are immediately adjacent on the Montreal West side? Have you counted? Yeah, between there and Montreal and Westminster, what, 500, something like that? It's like it's okay. So we'll.
That's the question. Thank you. That's it. Thank you. Hope it helps.
Alors, merci beaucoup pour les interventions très remplies des infos. Thank you very much for the very packed interventions. I would like to invite now Cornelia to speak on some of the general questions that are raised.
Okay. Hold it right up close to your mouth. Yes. Thank you. Good morning. I'm very honored to be able to speak about the generality of our finite planet. Bob Birkebeil told us, there's no time to lose, and we have got to think differently how we develop land. So I shall race through my presentation. Environment, please think about that. The surroundings or conditions in which a person, animal, or plant lives or operates. Ecology is a branch of biology. It was defined in 1866 by a biologist called Ernest Haeckel, and he pointed out to us the relations of organisms to one another and to their physical surroundings. Biodiversity, the variety and relationships among all living things in the world, that's human, animals, critters, whatever. And that is what we have to address on every side. Sustainability, a pattern of resource use that aims to meet human needs while preserving the environment. Now that comes from the Brundtland Report. In 1987 it was published, and my late husband Peter Oberlander pressed this book into my hands and said, this will change your landscape. And so it did. We must keep pace with ever-changing social needs which challenge us daily. If we want landscape architecture to become the art of the possible, as well as architecture and engineering and other professions, we must discover new aesthetically pleasing solutions, ecologically and technically sound ones, while satisfying social and economic goals. We need what I call VIM, not the polishing material in the house, but it's called vision, imagination, and motivation to accomplish these goals. Furthermore, we need new three R's, shouldering responsibility, willingness to take risks. That goes for politicians, that goes for all of us in the profession. And we need for every project research, analysis, and synthesis. Today, landscape architects, architects, engineers, biology, and other scientists have a critical role to play in mitigating the impact of environmental degradation of our planet. Climate change, I have experienced it not in Antarctica, but in the Arctic. I sank into what was frozen ground 5 years ago, is now a peat bog full of water. And climate change is with us. Indoor and outdoor air pollution and hard realities that can no longer be ignored or seen as problems too vast for individuals to influence. As designer, we can only solve problems in collaboration with other professionals, and we become leaders to develop site-specific solutions on each project. I shall now show you some of the projects that I have been involved with. In 1992, I had the great fortune to work with Bob Birkebeil at the University of British Columbia on the C.K. Choi building, which I will show you in 1 minute. This is a building for Asian research. It is situated on a parking lot. That meant limiting footprint. Nobody was allowed to go across the curb that was on the parking lot, and it's preservation of every tree in what is called the Asian precinct. And that meant labeling every tree. We didn't have GIS in 1992, so every tree is documented just poorly on a computer. Every tree was located, looked at for health, crossing branches, dead branches, etc. So we designed this building to catch water from the roof, to catch water from the sinks, to catch a liquid from the toilets, and we did not connect to the storm sewer nor the sanitary sewer. We have a gray water trench that cleans the plants, and we can use that water for irrigation, floor washing, or whatever we need. So this set the stage in 1995 when it was completed for the university to do this all over. only last week did they decide, well, you know, the water is finite, power is finite, we better learn. So they have learned only last week that this building 15 years ago was maybe worthy. Here is recycled building material. Here is a self-composting toilet. Here is a grey water trench. The plants clean the water. Flows in grey, brown. Middle is sort of brownish. And water flows out clear. You can drink it. The city inspector comes often on quite astounded and thinks it's a good idea. The windows open. Air pollution inside with whatever. Here, I don't see a single window that opens. These windows open. You can look into the forest. You can feel the ferns. The underplanting here is just the ecology of the forest. What I see, I plant. Here you see the trees denuded of its lower branches to let more light into the building. We hope to have collectors of sun for heating the water, but that hasn't been perfected in BC yet. I haven't seen the sun for 4 weeks. Now comes the Vancouver Public Library. This C.K. Choi building is one of the best 10 green buildings in North America still today. The architect was Eva Matsuzaki and Kiyo Matsuzaki, and we were a team with engineers and mechanical civil engineers, and we forged ahead by ourselves. The Vancouver Public Library competition was won with an accessible green roof. Unfortunately, that was not possible, and we had to think how to use the roof for insulation of heat, cooling, water retention. And so I designed a very simple landscape on the roof, which was nice to look at, with different fescues so that you can enjoy looking down at it. Construction was difficult. Only from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. was I allowed to bring the growing medium up to the roof and with a hopper. There was no crane available. So finally, the roof was laid out according to the plan. And 6 weeks later, these little things were growing like this. Today, the roof has been monitored. Because of the construction of the waterproofing was American Hydrotech membrane and an egg crate waffle on top, only 28% of the rainwater flows into the storm sewer. Had Moshe Safdie allowed a cistern in the building, I could have used that for floor washing. Here is the roof. On 14 inches of growing medium, we grow Japanese maples and all these wonderful plants. And the maintenance is only $20,000 a year for the whole building. This field is a football field of 30,000 square feet. And there are terraces. Now, I believe very strongly to have parks in the city. I believe very strongly in a green city. But today, what you need are neighborhood parks. And this is a neighborhood park at the university area at UBC. Very simple shapes, easy to maintain, zero carbon construction. The oval was scooped out because it was all clay. And with it, I built mounds to shield us from the traffic. They are designed ways of shielding us from noise. They are shielding us from visual impact. So then the scooped out gave us a mound and a wetland. This is a park that does not connect to the storm sewer. And in Vancouver, every storm sewer is overloaded. This is in the springtime. It's surrounded by high rises. These are lower rises, but by a huge high rise. And the developer had to give $250,000 to make this park, and I could build it for $248,000. And so I got a lot of daffodils, and the people just love it.
here, when and if the sun shines, everybody comes out, students, children, apartment dwellers, they can smell the roses. So it is design for people that matters. Here are for butterflies, plants that attract butterfly. There are Japanese children living there. They all have butterfly nets, and you should see how they chase them. And the wetland, when it rains, it fills up. Children can see their faces. That's the playground equipment. There is no playground equipment except sticks and stones and the mound. Now, in 1980, Arthur Erickson worked on a subdivision in West Vancouver. It's a community-owned, strata-titled-owned, and the houses are wedged into the forest. We did not take any trees down. We denuded some of these trees from the lower branches so there would be a view. And it was Eva Matsusaki and myself who limited the footprints of each house by denoting exactly the size of the house, and they all have roof, green roofs. And as you see, it's grown into a magnificent landscape of discovery. So I visualize that Meadowbrook could look like this. And here is the road going up, many rocks, and ecology is nice. This renews itself. And the only plant that we used was nickenick for the roof, moss, and some rhododendrons to give people pleasure, and they were all species rhododendron. And whatever grows, grows. This is a roof garden on an island for a gentleman who likes to sit on his roof. So the roof even is accessible. They can take walks on this roof, and he has several sitting places where he can enjoy the roof. He doesn't have a garden. He just has this as his garden. And so you see, even at Meadowbrook, we could make the roofs useful, because when you take the footprint of a building, you can replace it with a roof, green roof. Here is more of the green roof. And that was taken about 4 weeks after we established the sedums. Now, I believe strongly in community participation in urban agriculture, and I have several schools which I donate my spare hours to on urban agriculture. And I can see that today in every community we have to teach, learn, encourage people to grow their own vegetables. We will not have time, money, or petrol in a few years to come to the California Baja. Here I'm teaching them to see. Here we are harvesting, and you wouldn't believe it, we had even strawberries in November.
1 minute, please.
Yeah? I'm finished.
Yeah.
And don't be, and please, the bird even comes. I'm a devotee of David Suzuki, and he says, recognize that we live in a world where everything is connected to everything else, and so whatever we do has repercussion. We owe to the future generations to think about them before we leaping ahead. And I think that is what we have to think about.
Thank you so much, Cornelia. And it's my pleasure now to introduce Mr. Paul Kephart.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, and thank you, Cornelia. Your work has inspired me for many years, and I appreciate all the great ideas and your vision. And I'm also appreciative of your passion, your commitment to your ideas and your beliefs, and I want to try and define my comments and suggestions. I'll talk a little bit about an ecological approach, a restorative approach. I'll define and imagine some large-scale North American precedents of ecological design. I want to try and synthesize the comments and the great presentations that I heard this morning in relationship to both the challenges that we'll face as well as opportunities, and use those comments as a springboard for the discussions that we'll pursue. Rana Creek is, we've been working for 25 years in the field of restoration ecology. Some of the work we do is focused on the understanding of a site's capacity for carbon sequestration and water quality and quantity, waste and nutrient streams and recycling, the energy flows and conservation of energy. We're interested in understanding that elusive topic of human health and well-being and productivity, and looking at this from a regional context. And I was very appreciative of your comments this morning about looking at this site in terms to its relationship to the outside, whether it's a habitat and corridor and connectivity, or if it's the surrounding community. We cannot, while you described this morning as an island, I think we have to look at places outside the site. Large-scale precedents in terms of water. We're embarked on the design of a 6-hectare park, some 3 stories above the urban center of San Francisco. My job is often to encourage life and speak for those creatures that have no voice in the midst of concrete, glass, and steel. This park is on a train terminal and bus station. It has 6 foot of growing media with mature trees. The big idea behind this design is to encourage as much open water and wetland ecology as possible, primarily for carbon sequestration and purification of water and air. Another key factor of this project is that it's the first large-scale commercial graywater system that is operating as part of the structure. And I think the idea of incorporating living systems doesn't differentiate between site and structure. And I think some of Cornelia's images depicted how we can lift up that ecology and support it on the structure. Another large-scale American precedent is the Croton Water Treatment Plant in New York City in the Bronx, where some 9 acres of rooftop is seamlessly integrated into Van Cortlandt Park. And I think you'll find this interesting, that a golf course with all of its topography, a driving and tee range is incorporated on top of the deck with topography, rolling hills, the tees. And the key here is that 100% of the stormwater, the nutrients of the golf course operation, as well as groundwater that's contaminated with chromium, is pumped and relayed through a series of constructed wetlands in a large croissant that takes its course all the way around through the topography in shallow constructed meadows and wetlands, looking at residency time and flow rate in order to purify and cleanse that water and reuse all of the water on site. The key here is homeland security. The plenums can't be accessed. It also blends seamlessly into the surrounds. Probably one of the greatest projects now in North America relative to biodiversity and what we've learned is situated in a park in San Francisco. That's the California Academy of Sciences. some 2.5 acres of rolling hills and two very steep domes. And we designed that with a purpose. We wanted to integrate and replicate and simulate the diversity of plant community structure and density and form on top of the structure, including inoculating that roof with local soils and microbial organisms. What we found is very interesting in that 56% greater numbers of flying creatures and insects now occupy the rooftop than anywhere in the entire Golden Gate Park, and 36% of those creatures are not found in the park. So these elevated rooftops are actually repositories for conservation biology. And the probably my favorite of all precedents is a project built in 1878 in Lucerne, Switzerland, where some 123 species of vascular plants are found on some water tanks 5 acres in size, 8 species of orchids, 4 of which are extinct in the wild. So this is our opportunity. Our opportunity is to learn how we can adapt our culture, our developments, and our lifestyles into a modern context. And this is a very difficult challenge. From a developer's standpoint, we have to create performance criteria both for building performance but also for the site. And how do we develop those? They have to be linked to some monitoring and reporting criteria. They have to be reasonable and attainable. But also we need to understand what are those remedial measures. What happens if things don't work out? What happens if we use more energy than we specified? What do we do if we don't attract certain species of butterflies that we designed for? And I think we need to focus our discussions this afternoon around all of these topics, about biodiversity, about community and urban planning, and also about our willingness to share our ideas, our willingness to describe and define our goals and interests. And I look forward to participating with you this afternoon. This has been very informative and inspiring to me, and I share with your passion for the Meadowbrook site and the future that it holds. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we're just going to bring back up the slide that shows, oh, it's always hard to do this when everyone's watching, find the little button that says put it onto the full screen projection. These are the 4 themes for the workshops, and I think Danielle will provide some of the logistical details about in which rooms they are taking place. We're going to spread apart in the building, and then we're going to reconvene in G10, room G10, which is our large auditorium on this floor.
Thank you, Nick. So we are going to divide you into 8 groups. 2 groups will discuss on theme number 1. 2 other groups will discuss on theme number 2. Again, 2 groups on theme number 3. And lastly, 2 groups again on the theme number 4. You have a small paper with a room number written on it. This is where we want you to go for the next hour. Yeah, sure. Theme number 1 here at the in this room, we will use the front and the back of the room. For theme number 2, 5th floor, room 512. At the 5th floor for theme number 2. Theme number 3, room 206 and 102. 206 and 102. And finally, for the theme number 4, room 212 and 102. For the next hour, you will be discussing with moderators. And at 11:30, as Nick said, we will meet you here at the room G10. Yes, Paul?
Can you introduce the moderators?
Yeah. For the team number one, moderators will be David Brown and Gabrielle, the one that you met this morning. Team number two, you will be with Lisa Brownstein and Stephanie Sanchez. Team three, Luc Rabouin from Le Centre d'écologie and Nick Lucas from McGill. And finally, for the team number four, you'll be with Jason Prince and Catherine van der Meulen.
Oh, je vais te le donner, Patrick.